2012, February 28th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 37, The Pale Blue Dot, Searching for Other Earths. Our goal is to find planets around other stars and hopefully find life around them. And when we talk about life, we really are being very provincial. We're thinking Earth-like conditions. Warm, liquid water, planet in the habitable zone, planet about the size of the Earth with a solid surface, probably oceans. This is what we'd really like to find. As we saw in the last couple of days, we've made great progress over the last couple of decades in finding planets around other stars. As of a couple of days ago, we know of 760 stars. I'm sorry, 760 planets around other stars. Vast explosion of information. But the one thing we haven't found yet are habitable Earths, Earth-sized planets in the habitable zones of their parent stars. And today I want to talk about this goal to seek for the pale blue dot. And then the question is, once we find one, how can we learn whether or not it might harbor life? And so today we're going to be talking about the search for other Earths. So the basic goals, the basic ideas to get across today are, first and foremost, finding Earths is hard. Direct detection of exo-Earths is hard because they are so small and so extremely faint compared to their parent stars. This is probably one of the hardest problems in astronomy today. But if we can find them, if we can actually see them and take a picture of an Earth around another planet, or more importantly, take a spectrum of these planets, we can learn a tremendous amount about them. And we're going to learn what we can do, not by finding one of these planets, but by observing our own planet as if it were a discovered exo-Earth. What if we observe our planet from the outside? What does it look like? What does it tell us about the properties of our planet? We're going to see that the spectrum of the Earth, the distribution of colors as a function of wavelength, have two very strong humps in it. A reflected spectrum of sunlight, not surprisingly, sunlight bounces off, and a thermal emission spectrum. And that thermal emission spectrum is very important. The thermal spectrum can tell us the size and temperatures of the exo-Earths. And in particular, the reflection spectrum is going to contain some features. Some of those features are what we refer to as spectral biomarkers. They're things that that basically show the presence of life either on our planet or on an exo-Earth. This is where we have an advantage of being able to study our planet from the outside through various tricks. We kind of know what to look for. We know what the needle's going to look like if we're going to go search in a huge cosmic haystack. Finally, we can get even more information if I don't just take a picture, but I take many pictures over time and watch how the brightness of the exo-Earth varies. I'll be able to see things like oceans, continents, and weather. Now, whether we can reconstruct an image of the surface is unclear, but we can actually learn a surprising amount by just simply measuring a pale blue dot if ever we find one in space. And so today, we're going to go through this and show you just what we can learn and why the search for exo-Earths is so exciting and the possibilities for the future are going to be quite amazing when we actually get some candidates to study. To date, the simple answer is we have not yet found Earth-mass planets around other stars. We're very close. We found Earth-size things, but we don't know that Earth-size means Earth-mass yet. But the hunt is on. We're really getting close. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if this year, or at least in the next year or two, we get actual confirmable results of an Earth-mass planet in the habitable zone of its parent star. That's our ultimate goal. That's what we would like to find, because that's where we think is the most likely place to find life. The radial velocity methods that we talked about yesterday are currently insensitive to Earth-mass planets. Being able to see the orbital reflex of a parent star due to the gravity of an Earth-mass planet in an Earth-like orbit around it is going to require getting precision of measuring velocities down to centimeters per second in an astronomical context. That's super hard. There are technologies that are being developed that are getting there. They're clawing there centimeter by centimeter, but they're not there yet. That's really a next-generation technique that will probably require the building of much larger telescopes, getting up to 30 and 40 meters compared to the giant 10-meter class telescopes of today. The transit methods, particularly transit methods from space, like the Kepler mission, are extremely sensitive to large planets. And in fact, they've found mostly large planets. But the Kepler mission is really changing that equation because it's been able to bump up the precision of measuring the brightness, the depth of these little eclipses, to really, really small variations, down to a part in 10,000 to a part in 100,000. And that's what you need to get down to finding Earths. And as we're going to see in just a moment, the first few candidates are starting to come out just now, in the last few months, and more are on the way. The gravitational microlensing technique that was pioneered here at Ohio State has a tremendous capacity to find Earth-like planets in its next generation, guys. But this is not going to be good for nearby stars. This is going to be finding Earth-like planets in their Earth-like orbits in much more distant stars. We don't have any hope of being able to take images or spectra of these. But what we can get out of this is a global census, an idea of how often such planets are found in the habitable zones of their stars. That bears more on the general demographics of the possibility of life. And that gets into more of the questions we're going to be addressing in tomorrow's lecture when we introduce the idea of the Drake equation. So this is what we're looking for. We're looking for a place that looks an awful lot like home, maybe not as it is today, but perhaps at some phase of its history. We're looking for a warm planet with liquid water, an atmosphere in the habitable zone of its parent star. This is probably the machine that's going to show us the first of these. This is an artist's impression of Kepler. Kepler's in a high orbit around the Earth. It's staring at a single place near the constellation of Cygnus and measuring millions of stars to extremely high precision. And it's particularly targeting the F, G, K, and M stars in that zone, looking primarily for these little tiny part in 10,000, part in 100,000 transits of an exo-Earth crossing in front of its parent star. It hasn't found any actual exo-Earths in its habitable zone yet, but it's getting close. As of a couple months ago, this is from the end of December in 2011, these are a series of candidate planets, Kepler-20e and F. The Kepler-20 system is unusual in having a very large number of planets. It's the first time they've really cracked into sort of this Earth size here. So this is Kepler-20f and Kepler-20e with the Earth shown to scale. Recently, Kepler object of interest number 961, and to give you an idea, the current candidate list for planets that are of interest is up over 2,000 systems, 2,000 stars at this point. But star number 961, in just the last couple of weeks, has been announced to have three Earth and even near Mars-sized planets around an M dwarf, a red dwarf star. The red dwarf stars are small. They're only a little bit bigger in size than Jupiter. So the eclipse depth for one of these things is much bigger. You actually are kind of biased to finding things like that around red dwarfs. Now, the thing about all these planets is, while they're pretty solid as these things go, they're all what we would call hot planets. They are closer to their parent stars than the habitable zones. They're much too hot to support stable liquid water on their surface. In fact, the three sort of sub-Earth down to almost Mars-sized planets around KOA 961 are very close and pretty roasted out. They're going to be sort of Mercury-like in their surface conditions. They probably don't even have atmospheres. Whereas Kepler-20e is certainly a very hot planet. The sort of color scheme is kind of to emphasize that. And Kepler-20f, it's kind of a toss-up what it's like. It's definitely probably super-Earth, but whether it has an atmosphere or anything, that's just the NASA artists going nuts. All we know about these things is their size and their orbit positions. All the rest of these pictures are NASA had to put something pretty on the press release picture. But this sort of thing is really exciting. A year ago, we didn't know of any of these. In fact, I would say 3 or 4 months ago, we didn't know of any of these as confirmed planetary systems. But now, pretty much the best way to put the bottom line is the hunt is on, the techniques are delivering, it's only a matter of time now. Before, we wondered, could Kepler do it? The answer is yes, Kepler can find these planets. Will Kepler find the ones we really want to see, and that's an Earth in the habitable zone? Stay tuned. Watch the press releases. Also, I would say, don't believe everything you see in the press. You believe me, the first one's going to be subject to intense scrutiny before it's confirmed. But there's going to be a lot of front page news on it very quickly. But once you find it, all Kepler does is says, there's an Earth here. It doesn't take a picture. It can't. The Earth-like planet, the exo-Earth, would be too close to its parent star, and it's too faint to see in the glare. It's going to require next-generation, fearsomely expensive space missions to follow this up. Both the European Space Agency and NASA are at work on concepts to now go beyond Kepler. Now, once we've gotten candidates to look at from the Kepler observations or other data that could possibly generate candidates, we really want to go and get a picture of these and ultimately we want to get a spectrum of these. The goal is, first and foremost, you'll want that picture of the pale blue dot around another star. And second, you want to put a spectroscopic search on this, because as we're going to see in a moment, if the planet has an atmosphere and water, and if it has life, there are very distinctive spectroscopic markers in there that are the presence of life. They're called spectroscopic biomarkers, and that's the real excitement. These are a couple of different mission concepts. Whether any of these will fly, these are multi-billion dollar missions, are somewhat difficult to say. People are doing simulations now as to how these would perform. They use these techniques, which basically is a very high-tech way of putting your thumb in front of the bright light source that's glaring in your face so you can see the faint things surrounding it. It's a procedure basically called coronography. This is an example of that. This is a simulated Earth-like planet in an Earth-like orbit around a nearby G-star. This is a computer graphics simulation. The speckles and stuff you see out here are part of this light suppression technique called coronography. This is the hope. This is the possibility that you can actually, in a high-tech way, hold your thumb in front of the parent star and look for the little tiny faint glow of a pale blue dot next to it. That's the goal, but we haven't gotten there yet. So today what I really want to talk about is when we get there, we're doing the footwork now, what are we going to be looking for? How would we study these things when we find them to ask the question of, is it a life or potentially life-bearing world? We can't answer that with anything to look at now, but we can do that. We don't have any other exo-Earths to study yet, and we don't have the technical means yet, but we can do this. We can prepare for these studies by studying our own planet from the outside. Now, I'll remind you of this really stunning picture. It came out a few years ago. It was taken with the Cassini spacecraft, which is in orbit around the planet Saturn, and it looked back on the inner solar system when the sun is being eclipsed by the main body of the planet Saturn. Now, what catches everyone's attention is, of course, the bright rings of ice being lit up by the sunlight scattering them. But that little tiny dot there is not a star. That's our Earth, seen from a distance of 1 billion kilometers away. This is what we look like from space. That is quite literally a pale blue dot. The term pale blue dot comes from a much earlier portrait of the inner portion of our solar system, a picture of our Earth from far outside. It was made in 1990 by the Voyager 1 spacecraft, which at that time was 6.4 billion kilometers away on its way out of the solar system. It was about reaching the limit of the distance at which the ground receivers could actually still get camera imaging data from the Voyager spacecraft. Once it got a certain distance beyond, it could only switch down to the low power modes, low power telemetry for some of the plasma experiments, but it couldn't transmit back full images. Cameras were pretty old at that point, too, remembering that the Voyager 1 mission was launched in the middle 1970s, and it was working on space for more than 50 years. In fact, it's still working today, still transmitting. These stripes you see are actually scattered sunlight, and the camera went back and took what was called the family portrait. It was sitting back at the edge of the solar system and looked back and took a picture of every single one of the planets from the perspective of this quickly outmoving spacecraft. And it took this particular striking picture of this tiny pale blue dot, as the late Carl Sagan referred to it. This is perhaps one of the two pictures of the Earth that really were game changers in the human perception of the Earth. The first of those was the first picture that was taken of the entire disk of the Earth when the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 8 were on their way to the moon and turned back and actually saw our planet as a whole disk planet while on the way out to the moon. They saw the Earth with its thin sheath of an atmosphere, the land, the oceans. It was one of those pictures that in the early 1960s really galvanized public perception of what the Earth was. It was one of those pictures that gave rise, among other things, to the modern environmental movement, because it showed the tiny Earth in the midst of the blackness of space. It galvanized for a lot of people how fragile the Earth really is when viewed in its actual context. We've been living here for millions of years, but that was the first time we ever could turn around and as human beings look back on our own home world. Well, we can't go out to 6 billion kilometers, but we can look back with our proxy robotic eyes on spacecraft like Voyager. And what we see is the Earth is really tiny. It's very small. It's lost in a very great blackness of space. And this idea of the pale blue dot here really galvanized the question of what would we look at, what would it look like to find one of these other Earths, one of these islands of life in immense darkness of space around another star. Sagan probably correctly pointed out that it would be an immensely galvanizing experience again for the human race, but even more so if we could find evidence that planet harbored life, because it would be the first sign that we were not alone in the universe. And what change that would work in culture is almost unpredictable. The question is, what are we going to look for and what are we going to find? Oops, going across here. So what would we find? If we find one of these pale blue dots, what are we going to look for? Well, we haven't found one yet, but we can look back at our Earth from a distance, or we can play various tricks using spacecraft as if we can look at our Earth and study it from the outside. The first thing we can look at, of course, is those pictures show the little pale blue planet against the dark velvet blackness of space. The other thing we can do is we can take the light from that pale blue dot and spread it out into a spectrum and ask what that spectrum tells us. Spectra can tell us a tremendous amount of information. And what we find out is that the spectrum of the Earth, when viewed from afar, is this kind of double hump spectrum here. It's got two major spectral components. The first of these is to remember that the Earth does not have shine by its own light, invisible light in ultraviolet, but shines by reflected sunlight. And so one component of the Earth's spectrum is simply taking the spectrum of the sun, and it's reflecting off of cloud tops, the oceans, the land, snow, and so forth. The amount of decrease in the brightness is more than a factor of a million. In fact, the decrease in brightness of the sun from the Earth is down about 100 million, depending upon the different spectral regions you're talking about. So this yellow dot here is the spectrum of the reflected sunlight simply dialed down by the little tiny reflector, an imperfect reflector indeed, that is the Earth. And we see that that pretty well matches most of the visible and ultraviolet spectrum over here on the left. But as we press out into the from the ultraviolet and visible to the infrared, we notice in the infrared the spectrum starts to pick up again. A second hump forms. And that's there because the Earth is warm. And warm bodies emit infrared radiation. If I cut off all the lights in this room and brought in a thermal infrared camera, I would see a dark room and a whole bunch of glowing outlines of people because we have body temperatures around 98 degrees Fahrenheit. I never remember what the body temperature is in Celsius, 37, something like that. The Earth has the body temperature of about 300 degrees Kelvin, about room temperature. And that has a very characteristic second hump spectrum, which peaks out at infrared wavelengths. So the Earth really does shine by its own radiation, but its own radiation is because it's heated by the sun. And we know that that infrared is pouring off the Earth, but some of it gets trapped by the Earth's atmosphere, by the greenhouse gases that keeps our atmosphere warmer than it would be if no atmosphere was present. So instead of getting the red line spectrum, I get a series of dips, which are the absorptions from water vapor, carbon dioxide, oxygen, that are among the greenhouse gases on the Earth. So this twofold spectrum is really important to look at. Now, combined, the Earth is about 2 billion times fainter than the sun. So here is the promise. The spectrum contains a lot of information, considering especially because as you pass through the atmosphere, you leave absorption lines from that atmosphere behind, and the emission spectrum that coming out in the infrared lets you measure the surface temperature. That's a tremendous amount of information about the planet and its potential for habitability. The challenge is here. It's 2 billion times fainter than the sun as seen from the outside. You've got to obliterate, essentially, the light from the sun and see a bare fraction of a billionth of the light of the sun is due to the Earth, and the Earth is really close to that bright star. This is what makes it so terribly hard. These planets are small. They are not very shiny. They're going to be hard to see. So let's take a look at these two different components of the spectrum and see what we learn from it. This is the dash line here, the dark line that goes jigging up and down and dips down, is the actual spectrum of the Earth measured with distant spacecraft. This is the infrared spectrum of the sun, of the Earth. It's cut off the visible reflection spectrum. So this piece picks up where the reflection spectrum takes over. The different black lines that are drawn through there are thermal spectra of different temperatures. 175 degrees Kelvin, 200 Kelvin, 225, 250, 275. Remember that the liquid water temperature, the freezing point of water, is 273 degrees Kelvin. This final black line is 300 degrees Kelvin, room temperature. So we can see that the spectrum of the thermal spectrum is pretty close to a 300 degree Kelvin blackbody. It's actually a little bit less. That 287 degrees Kelvin we talked about, 290 degrees Kelvin we've talked about before. But you'll notice it doesn't follow the curve exactly. It's carved up by deep absorption lines. One of these, of course, is carbon dioxide. There are broad bands of water vapor, which are part of what carves it down in these regions. This is a strong water vapor absorption here. So if we have carbon dioxide and water vapor are the principal greenhouse gases that keep our atmosphere nice and warm. And what's happening is the heat radiation, the infrared radiation coming off of the body of the Earth has to pass back up through the atmosphere before it gets into space. And the atmosphere in the greenhouse molecules of carbon dioxide and water vapor take their cut. They absorb some of that infrared up. And so as seen from the outside, we see the dips where that infrared radiation is removed by the greenhouse gases. This is what goes into heating our atmosphere. But there's also another feature in this spectrum that I've outlined in blue. That's ozone, O3. O3 is formed when ultraviolet radiation breaks apart O2, molecular oxygen, and it recombines in the high atmosphere. O2 got in our atmosphere how? From photosynthetic life. So in addition to showing that we have a carbon dioxide and water vapor in our atmosphere, and the Earth's atmosphere is 300 degrees Kelvin, it also shows that there's ozone in the upper atmosphere of the Earth. This is one of the spectral biomarkers we're going to come back to. So the infrared spectrum gives you a lot of information. It tells you the temperature. It also lets you measure the size of the Earth in detail, because you can measure how much radiation is coming off, and that gives you kind of like a measurement of the wattage of the light bulb. So it gives a lot of information from the thermal spectrum. That reflection spectrum, what we would measure at ultraviolet to visible to getting out into the near-infrared radiation, actually carries a lot of information too. You take sunlight. The sunlight passes down through the atmosphere. Part of it bounces off clouds. Part of it bounces off ocean. Part of it bounces off the land, which can be covered with sand or snow or vegetation. And then the light passes back out through the atmosphere again. So you get absorption going in and absorption again coming out, plus getting absorption or altering of that spectrum as the light interacts with the oceans, the land, vegetation on the surface. So this is, in fact, this dark spectrum here. It's kind of hard to get a really good UV to near-infrared spectrograph on a big spacecraft. So what we do instead is we use a convenient mirror, the moon. If you get the moon in a faint crescent phase, if you ever watch it, if we actually get some clear weather during crescent phase this winter, so many of you have seen what's called Earthshine. You can actually see, while the bright crescent of the moon is lit up by the sun, you can actually see the rest of the moon in very, very faint glow. That's the moon reflecting Earthshine. So this Earthshine spectrum, we can take a spectrum of that, and we have. The Earthshine spectrum is shown as the black wavy line here. This is not noisy. This is actual spectral features in the spectrum. You see a big rise to the blue, the sky is blue. Well, that's part of what you're seeing, is the atmosphere of the Earth very strongly reflects and scatters blue light. And that gets, some of that gets scattered into our eye and makes the sky look blue. Other blue light bounces back up off the Earth and back into space. So the spectrum of the Earth rises at blue wavelengths. When you take out the sun spectrum, this Earth spectrum is a little bit bluer than the sun spectrum because of this Rayleigh scattering, as it's called, the upper atmosphere molecule scattering. Then you see a series of absorption bands, absorption lines, because we've passed through the atmosphere and back out. These absorption lines are due to things like ozone in the ultraviolet, O2, molecular oxygen, very strong bands due to molecular oxygen in visible wavelengths. Water vapor absorption bands. Once again, we get water vapor absorption, especially as we get into the red and out into the near infrared. I'm a spectroscopist who works from ground-based observatories a lot. I have to look out through our atmosphere up at the sky. I built a UV to near-infrared spectrometer for the Large Binocular Telescope, and I can tell you these things are always getting in my face because any starlight coming from above is going to pass through the atmosphere and get absorbed. But similarly, sunlight going down through our atmosphere and back out will imprint these markers of the presence of molecular oxygen, ozone, and water on the spectrum. It gives us an idea of the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. Interestingly, nitrogen, the primary constituent of our atmosphere, does not leave simple, strong absorption lines. It just happens to be a property of the way in which the nitrogen line works. You can do it, but they're very, very weak. This blue spectrum under here is the Rayleigh scattering. This is the blue sky. And then we get two others. You know how oceans, water looks kind of blue? Part of that is because oceans, in fact, do reflect a little bit of blue light, preferentially to red light. But more interestingly is this green line. Vegetation actually is red. We are used to seeing it as green because our vision only spans this much wavelength, right? We can see from kind of here out to 7,000 angstroms at the edge. But if we had infrared eyes, we would actually see a vegetation signature coming up on the Earth. If there was no vegetation, if I took a spectrum of dead desert, this feature here doesn't appear. So the spectrum tells us even more. There's photosynthetic life, or Earth-like life, has a very distinctive spectral signature. Without seeing any green plants, we can see its effect, because what do plants do? They absorb sunlight and turn it into food. They absorb visible light, but they don't absorb infrared light. We'll see that a little bit more of that in just a second. So here's the big bottom line here. The reflection spectrum carries a huge amount of information. When we remove the bits that are the spectrum of its star, it tells us what important atoms or molecules are in that atmosphere. It tells us whether it has an atmosphere at all. If the Earth had no atmosphere, you'd get none of those bands because there'd be no atmosphere to absorb them. The sunlight would just bounce down and bounce right off. So it tells you you've got an atmosphere. The Rayleigh scattering tells you you've got an atmosphere. And whether you've got oceans or vegetation, also puts its signature on the outgoing spectrum. So we can glean out of these various spectral features, some of these tell us about the atmosphere, but some of these tell us what are called biomarkers. In particular, we're going to pay attention to the biomarkers in the infrared part of the spectrum. Why the infrared? Twofold. One is, most stars like the sun emit mostly visible light. They're a billion times or 2 billion times brighter than the reflected sunlight coming off the Earth. But in the infrared, stars don't emit as much. They emit some, but not as much. But the planets are self-luminous because they're hot. And that contrast goes from a few billion to about a million or so. So the planet is actually visible in better contrast in the infrared than it is in the visible light. So if we concentrate on the infrared, we get a lot of important spectral biomarkers. Among these biomarkers are important because we know that on Earth, the presence of these molecules is related to the presence of life, in particular photosynthetic life. Oxygen, of course, molecular oxygen, O2, is really good because we know that molecular oxygen in our solar system has only arisen on the Earth, and it's only arisen because of photosynthesis. Ozone is pretty good, too, because you make ozone out of O2. So it's a double whammy there. In fact, while O2 is really good, it's got very strong features, unfortunately, those features are very easily masked by other features, so you can get a false positive. But ozone, it turns out to be very distinctive. It's made through photochemistry with sunlight shining on the O2. So while you can get an ambiguous answer from O2 in the infrared because it's all strongly blended in with water vapor and other stuff, ozone stands alone, really strong, right in the middle of the infrared wavelengths at around 10 microns, around the peak of infrared radiation. Water vapor shows up fairly strongly in the spectrum of the infrared spectrum of a planet. It's useful because it tells us there's water vapor in the atmosphere, and that is necessary But it's not sufficient to show that there's life there. It just shows that there's water in the atmosphere. But it doesn't tell us whether the water is liquid. It just tells it is present. The other one is really surprising. Methane. On planets with oxidizing atmospheres, terrestrial planets, methane is unstable. It should go away in about 300 years if I make it through a volcanic process, for example. But life, especially anaerobic bacteria, make methane in copious quantities. The primary sources of methane on our planet are a little bit from volcanic outgassing, rotting vegetation being eaten up by bacteria, a sort of stinky swamp smell is part and parcel of both methane and sulfur production, sulfur bacteria. These are bacteria that don't use, some of them use sunlight, some of them use sulfur to make their byproducts, so they produce sulfur, hydrogen sulfide and methane. And bacteria that live in the lower and large intestines of sheep, cows, and most mammalian life that eats vegetation. In other words, sheep farts contain methane. So if you've got large ruminant animals, you can make methane, and it will go into the atmosphere and has a very strong biomarker. So let's play this game. This game is actually played with different spectrographs which have been flown on spacecraft, and it shows what the spectra of the three main terrestrial planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars, look like when viewed as a whole. The Earth has strong water vapor absorption, very strong ozone absorption in the infrared, and a strong carbon dioxide absorption. Not too surprising there. Venus has no water vapor, no ozone, but a very strong carbon dioxide signature. Venus's atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide. It's lost most of its water vapor because of a runaway greenhouse effect. Mars has had most of the water vapor frozen out of its atmosphere, so it has virtually no water vapor in its atmosphere. No ozone to speak of, but it's got a 95% carbon dioxide atmosphere, and so it shows a very strong carbon dioxide feature. So what do we conclude from these? Well, alien astronomers looking down on our solar system from a great distance and taking spectra of the three brightest terrestrial planets, they took a spectrum of Mercury, barring reflected sunlight, no atmosphere. Three of those spectra planets have atmospheres. The carbon dioxide says, hey, oxygen-reducing atmosphere. They look different than the gas giants, which have a hydrogen-rich atmosphere. That's CO2. CO2 says oxidizing atmosphere, but we only find water vapor and ozone on that third rock. So an alien astronomers would be able to say, ignore Venus and Mars, or planet 2 and planet 4, but planet 3, let's take a closer look. So these biomarkers are very powerful, and it's very easily shown by what's going on in our own solar system. Methane is the surprising one. These are methanogens. They're methane-producing bacteria. These are methane bacteria that live in sheep guts. This produces a very strong infrared signature. Now, here is a spectrum of the Earth. This is a simulation. This is a calculation based on what we know from various fossil record pieces, various ways of measuring what's called the prebiotic Earth. So let's say the extraterrestrial astronomers are looking down on our solar system, but they're doing so 2 billion years ago, before the rise of really strong photosynthesis on our planet. This is what they would see. They'd see a little bit of oxygen somewhere, but you'd see a huge spectrum of carbon dioxide and water vapor. Nothing else. Because life isn't producing much methane. Switch on life, when biology really gets going, and bam, this huge, deep methane feature suddenly appears in the Earth's atmosphere. That's due to the very small amounts of methane that are being produced by methane-producing bacteria. This feature was really strong in the early Earth, before there was a lot of oxygen, and most of the bacteria were methanogens. When you got photosynthesis really kick into play, you start getting oxygen plentiful, it kills off the anaerobic, oxygen-poisoned bacteria, and the amount of methane production drops. So you could actually figure out by looking from the outside of the Earth in different parts of its history what kind of life dominates. In this period, Earth is being dominated by anaerobic bacteria producing methane. Today, anaerobic methane is very weak, But oxygen is very strong, and you know the Earth is now being dominated by oxygen-producing photosynthesis. So an awful lot of information is contained within a spectrum. Now, there's an old saying, a picture is worth 1,000 words. A spectrum is worth 1,000 pictures. If you take a spectrum of something, you'll learn a lot. You can learn even more. Some of it's surprising. Here's a picture of a piece of a forest in visible light, nice, green, lush, photosynthesizing vegetation. Go into the near infrared, and not very far into the infrared, 8,000 angstroms, just a little bit past what the eye can see with an infrared camera. Put a little false color on it so you can kind of see it, and all of a sudden, the place becomes bright. The plants are glowing a great deal. Why is that? Well, it turns out that there's something called the red edge in the reflection spectrum of plants. If you put white light onto a plant, green light has a wavelength of about 5,000, 4,000 angstroms. That's where most of the green light is. What we see is the reflectance spectrum doesn't contain much green light at all. It's absorbing that light. It is, because those photons are being used for photosynthesis. So the plant is absorbing those. It's absorbing their energy and using them to run photosynthetic chemistry. But there's a problem. Those photons are also heating the plant up. If they heat the plant up too much, the proteins will stop working, the enzymes will stop working, and the plant will die. So the plant has got to cool itself. It turns out chlorophyll becomes transparent and highly reflective, at red wavelengths. So the plant absorbs UV radiation, get a little bump in the green for chlorophyll. That's what makes chlorophyll look green. Absorb the energy to make food, get rid of your excess waste heat by giving you a way to radiate. So this red bump, as it's called, the red edge, is actually the way in which plants have evolved thermal regulation systems. It's how they keep cool in full sunlight so they don't dry up and wilt. This gives us a spectral biomarker. If there's plant life on a planet, I will get a sudden jump, a bump, at the red edge because of the reflection from the surfaces of all those leaves that are furled out to catch all that sunlight to make food. They're acting like little red reflectors. So they absorb in the green, but then reflect in the red. The absorption's really broad. It's really hard to see the chlorophyll signature of absorption in the blue, but the sudden jump in the red is very, very distinctive. In fact, this red edge is so distinctive that Earth-looking satellites, looking down and mapping out things like agriculture, plant life, forestry on the Earth, with like Landsat and other Earth-viewing satellites, use this red edge to know where plant life is. If you go look up, for example, satellite images of the state of Ohio, they can show you which fields are plowed down to dirt and which fields are actually growing corn, sorghum, or whatever it is they're growing out there this week. Because the fields that are full of plant life with leaves spread out appear as bright infrared sources, bright infrared reflectance sources. And bare ground? Just bare ground. And so it's a very distinctive way they can map all the different plant life around the entire planet by using this red edge. Well, if we can use it in the Department of Agriculture and NASA to map where the plant life is on the Earth, we could use a red edge if chlorophyll and evolution on these other worlds actually push you to a molecule like this, if they have a similar mechanism for thermal regulation, then we've got a way to see plant life around, the presence of plant life around another world. There's no guarantee that chlorophyll is the only way to do photosynthesis. It's the way our planet does it. But, hey, we're being provincial and we're looking around for some kind of handle, and this is one of them. So, find the planet, first and foremost. You might find it with transits. And you follow up with one of these things to take a picture of it, and you see the pale blue dot. Then you take a spectrum of it, and you can tell, does it have an atmosphere? Does it have a water? Does it have oxygen and ozone? That's probably a sign of photosynthetic life. Does it have methane? That might be an earlier epoch of anaerobic life, because methane should not be present and stable without life on an oxidizing atmosphere. Find a red edge. Cha-ching, you've found advanced land plant life. What else can you learn? Well, one thing you can do is you can go back to that picture. You might do it as a function of color, but you can watch it. and you watch the planet change in brightness. If you watch the Earth rotate, we have oceans, we have land, we have clouds that come and go with weather patterns, we have seasonal patterns. Bright, shiny snow in the northern hemisphere in winter is replaced by green plant life in the summer. So we go from really shiny, snowy surfaces to dark plant life surfaces and sand. So what you would see is you would see the brightness of the planet change. But since the planet's rotating, the pattern would repeat. So if you watch through a couple rotation cycles, you could figure out what fraction of the planet was covered by oceans or land. You could watch changing weather patterns over seasons. And you might even watch changing vegetation patterns if you go through seasonal variations as extreme as those upon the Earth. You could even tell if you've got gross climate problems, like desert planets, or snowball Earths, or even jungle worlds that are completely covered with plant life. They would show very different variability signatures. A Mars-like desert world would look different than a snowball Earth, which would look different than jungle Earth. At different times in the Earth's history, our variability pattern looked different. So we can use all this information to piece together something about the world. So using spectroscopy, using these spectral signatures and these photometric signatures tells us a lot. Okay? If we can get the spectral signatures, those are the real powerful ones. If you see ozone, you got oxygen. If you see the water vapor signature, you've probably got water. And the thermal conditions, the presence of the atmosphere and the heaviness of the atmosphere, can tell you if that atmosphere is able to carry stable liquid water on its surface. You can tell if you've got an atmosphere at all, and if you find methane, you got, wait for it now, life. So spectral biosignatures are extremely important. This is the real excitement. This is what we're going to push on once we find one of these exo-Earths. People will probably think, yeah, maybe it is worth spending a few billion dollars to put up a spacecraft to take a spectrum of that thing. Wouldn't you want to know whether that planet, Earth-like planet, in its habitable zone, harbors life? We've been looking for so long and wondering for so long through all of our history whether we're alone on a continent or alone on a planet or alone in the universe, that the possibility that somewhere else might have life will be absolutely irresistible. Think how it would change human perspective if we thought that we weren't the only intelligent beings or even only forms of life in our universe. So this is where we have to go. This is the long-term goal. The technology exists today to find the exo-Earths. In fact, it would not surprise me if a positive detection of an exo-Earth occurs this year or in the next couple of years. We're really, really close in the Kepler spacecraft. There's a lot of efforts going on in many different areas, from the ground, from space, which are moving in this direction. The real goal, taking a picture of that pale blue dot and taking a spectrum to find out what the conditions are like on that pale blue dot, especially to find those spectral biomarkers, that's for the future, probably the next 20 or 30 years. Okay, I'm kind of hoping optimistically 20 years based upon my present age and how long the men in my family live that I might see this one. You and your children will probably live to see the day when we actually find another Earth with life. It's really possible, and we're on our way to do that. Any questions? Okay, I will see you all tomorrow.